Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the very first day of December. And our guest this hour is author of Lincoln, President-elect Abraham Lincoln and the Great Secession Winter, 1860 to 1861. Harold Holzer writes in the introduction to the book, and this is just dumbfounding. Every time I say this or read it, it just amazes me. During these 4 months, a full third of a year between his election and inauguration, seven southern states seceded from the Union, set up their own independent government, chose their own president, seized federal property, and dared Lincoln to resist their defiant independence. Within 30 days of the November 1860 popular vote, in which notably he failed to amass even 40% of the total cast and earned none at all in much of the South, the minority elect could not even be certain that he would have a nation to lead. Harold Holzer is the author of this book, which looks at the 4 months between Lincoln's election and the inauguration. And this is the first book really to concentrate so fully on his public stance during this time. Harold has been celebrated for his knowledge of Civil War era events. He is considered one of the country's leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln, serves as co-chair of the United States Lincoln Bicentennial Commission, has authored and edited 31 books, including Lincoln at Cooper Union, The Speech That Made Abraham Lincoln President, Lincoln in the Times, The Life of Abraham Lincoln, as originally reported in the New York Times, State of the Union, New York and the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln the Writer, a children's book, Lincoln Seen and Heard, The Union Preserve, The Lincoln-Douglas Debates, and the list goes on. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him during this hour, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or send an email if you'd like. That is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Harold Holzer, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Yeah. Thank you for that nice long list. It exhausted me.
It exhausts me to think of all those writings. It's a wonderful book. I thank you so much for writing it. I think it is a profoundly interesting period, and nobody's paid the kind of attention to it that you have. You read about just that simple sentence that you wrote that I read. What this guy faced was unbelievable, wasn't it?
I know. In a way, it's somewhat comforting because things are difficult now, but they're not as difficult as they were when the country itself was in jeopardy. And of course, Lincoln had a little financial crisis and stock market decline to round out his day. You know, that was happening as well. So, it's entirely different. We can be thankful for the unity that's greeted Senator Obama's election anyway.
Right. You know what you really brought to life? Because I've been to Springfield several times in my life, and I love the town and love Abraham Lincoln. But you really brought to life what happened after he right as he was waiting for the results of the election and what happened after he won. This town is besieged by all of these people, you know, who he patiently sits and greets, who want jobs, who want to give him good wishes. And there's a tall Abraham Lincoln who's taken everything in and being fairly kind to everybody.
Yeah. You know, it was a different culture. We've all noticed that there are some bizarre similarities, but there were also differences. And Lincoln had no transition committee. He really didn't have much of a staff to deal with all of these things. He had open office hours. It was quite remarkable. He had open office hours at his Springfield headquarters, the state capitol building, and saw the public every day.
Mm-hmm. How did he take in the election results? How was he getting the news?
For a while, he sat in his office in the state capitol. Now that's the same building where Senator Obama appeared, at least the outside, to make his announcement for the presidency and also to introduce Senator Biden as his running mate. He was on the second floor there. He had occupied the governor's traditional office ever since his nomination because the governor was incapacitated and not using the space. So he, for a while, he was receiving telegrams that were run over from the other side of Capitol Square, where the city's only telegraph office was. People would just send in telegraph results. They would wire the results from distant locations around the country. After a while, he decided to avail himself of an invitation he'd received earlier in the week from the head of the telegraph office to spend time up there so that he wouldn't have to waste any time between the receipt of the telegram and the, you know, his absorbing of the news. So he settled in on a couch at the telegraph office and just began reading the telegrams one after another.
Mm-hmm.
And he had an amazing mind for figures in elections. He was so the newspapermen who were watching him marveled at the fact that when he got a report, you know, DeKalb County, 700 votes for you, 400 for Douglas, he would calculate on the difference between that vote and the vote in the senatorial elections 2 years earlier and the presidential election 4 years before that. So he knew that the trends were showing that Republicans were doing better than they had in their initial presidential race in 1856.
Interesting. And he was his election came, spend a few moments, because you talk about this nearly impotent Buchanan administration that preceded his. I mean, this guy just didn't do very much.
Well, he was really, he was just trapped by his own bizarre philosophy of the secession crisis. Mm. You know, here are seven states leaving the Union after the election, while he's still the president, seizing federal property in the South, including forts and munitions supplies and post offices and the U.S. Mint in New Orleans, for example. He believed that Southern states had no right to secede. We'll give him that. But he also believed that the federal government had no power to prevent them from seceding or to do anything once they seceded. So it was a prescription for disaster, or at least for total indifference. And in a way, although he wasn't, you know, a hostile lame duck, although he did give an annual message, his last State of the Union message, in which he blamed everything on the Republicans, all of the crises, he did nothing to make it easier for Lincoln, who was not going to ascend for 4 months.
What give me a sense of the Southern panic and how you explain the Southern panic over Lincoln's election?
The South believed that that Lincoln would be the cause of the end of slavery, and it turns out we can't really argue with that, I suppose, because he was.
Mm-hmm.
They thought that he would challenge their right to own slaves in the South, and as many times as he made clear that he would not interfere with slavery where it existed, they insisted that that they were fearful that he was. What it really boiled down to is that they sort of believed in his theory that that slavery need only be arrested, at least the spread of slavery needed to be arrested, that containing it would place it on what he called the course of ultimate extinction. He had said that for years as a means of assuring the South that he wouldn't interfere with slavery where it existed. But they sort of bought the argument. And to them, the argument meant that they had better stop this guy or he will choke off slavery and prevent us from electing new senators from new areas who would be pro-slavery, annexing Cuba, annexing Mexico. So they saw in Lincoln the death knell to slavery, and they were absolutely not prepared to allow it to happen.
Mm-hmm. And how vocal was Lincoln during this period in terms of outlining where indeed he was going to go with this whole issue? Was he talkative? Was he quiet? Was he behind the scenes?
He was beyond quiet. He was purposely and intensely silent about what he called doctrinal points. He said, everything I've said on the issue is published. I need say no more. The Republican Party platform mandates that we prevent the spread of slavery under any circumstances, and that's my policy. I was elected on it, and I'm not going to change it. And there it was, and there it stood. He had no intention of speaking out because anything he said would have fractured the country further. So it was a very wise policy. You know, he won all of the northern states except for New Jersey. But if he had spoken out, he would have alienated the 45% of the people in the North who voted against him. That's a sizable number.
Mm-hmm.
Anything he said that was hostile to the South might have driven more states out. Anything he said that was conciliatory might have offended the abolitionists who believed that they had finally elected an anti-slavery man to the presidency. So he conducted a policy of what he called masterly inactivity, and it was masterly. He kept the lid on the crisis to the extent he could, and he very deliberately and diligently saw to it that slavery would not be expanded, even if that might have stemmed the secession crisis. He didn't think that was a trade worth making.
Hmm. You talk about in the book the people criticizing him for not confronting this issue much more directly before the inauguration, but you also say that the suggestion he was unaware of the severity of the problem was both unfair and inaccurate. Indeed, it kept him up at night, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was the beginning of the sleeplessness that plagued him for the rest of his life. Mm. He was never going to sleep again, really, the poor guy. But he had a choice to make, and he was making the choices, I think he had no choice publicly but to say, I'm hoping that the loyal Union people of the South come to their senses and realize that they can't fight Union. I mean, what else was he going to say? He was hoping that the crisis would end, and he hoped that there were Union people in the South who would rise to the occasion, but they didn't. And I don't think that means he misunderstood the crisis. I think it meant that he put the best face on it that he could.
And he was receiving reports from the South and from those who just didn't like this guy at all. There were a lot of threats against this man, weren't there, during this time period? Really horrible letters he was receiving?
Letters and pictures and effigies,
right,
and emblems and threats that he was going to be poisoned, that his ink was going to be tampered with. He had every reason to believe that that he might not make it to the inauguration, and even so, he decided on a very public journey to Washington, which he believed the country deserved, that believed the North deserved to see him, and he also really needed to sort of get his politician's chops back in operation again, because he actually had not done any campaigning for the entire election process. It was, again, it was part of the culture that presidential candidates stay home,
mm-hmm,
and he did.
That really struck me. I didn't realize there wasn't any campaigning that went on. Isn't that
something?
Well,
Stephen Douglas, his opponent, decided that his mother was so sick in Vermont that he ought to go visit her, and he did, and he was criticized brutally for doing it. They did cartoons of him called Little Stephen in Search of His Mother, because everywhere his train stopped to take on water and coal, he gave a speech, and people were on to it. They said, this is outrageous. Can you imagine no campaigning at all? It's sort of a nice thought, instead of 2 years of campaigning.
Right. No, I can't quite imagine that. Tell me a little bit about the cabinet, and set the scene in Chicago where he's going to get his, I think it was the same trip, maybe it was another one, he's going to get his special cashmere suit for the inauguration.
Yes, it's the same trip.
Same trip, and he's meeting with people to be potential members of the cabinet.
Well, not with them directly, although William Seward, the Hillary Clinton of 1860,
right,
you know, the New York senator who was favored to win the nomination, who didn't get it, who was not a happy camper, and came around and campaigned for the ticket. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Campaigned very loyally for for Lincoln, and then he gets the summons that Lincoln wants to consider him as Secretary of State. Well, I don't know if that's happened yet today, but I guess it's going to happen today.
I think it happened just a couple minutes ago.
Oh, it did?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's real, right?
It's real.
Okay. Sorry, I missed it.
Yeah, I did too.
He goes to Chicago to have a reception and to see some advisors, and he is just besieged with ideas for cabinet selection, and bombarded. And Seward decides that not only should Lincoln appoint him, but that he should come to Chicago to be part of the meeting. Of course, we all know that Hillary went to Chicago to see Senator Obama, Lincoln sent word that he didn't want Seward to come to the meeting. Actually, Seward wanted Lincoln to go to Auburn to pay homage to him at his hometown,
no,
which Lincoln wasn't going to do. Chicago was a fallback position. And that was his one public trip before going to off to Washington. And it was eye-opening. The crowds, the tumults, the office seekers, the demands, the request from photographers that he posed for pictures. It was all the beginning of this brave new world he was about to enter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there it was in Chicago.
Exactly.
Right. Similarities are astounding. Let's welcome phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. We're speaking with the author of a terrific book, Lincoln, President-Elect, Abraham Lincoln and the Great Secession Winter, 1860 to 1861. Harold Holzer is our guest. Harold is the co-chair of the U.S. Lincoln Bicentennial Commission and has authored or co-authored some 30 books on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now and start with Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
I take part in Civil War reenactments during the summer months in southern Wisconsin and northern Illinois. And the gentleman who does Lincoln in Illinois is Max Daniels. And he, I don't know if your author, your guest, is acquainted with him or not, but he's rather tall. He looks just about like him, and he is just great. He'll high-five the kids, and the kids have to jump up to high-five him. But there's respect and the admiration. When I gave up on that shoeshine stand, the respect and the admiration when people will gather around is just remarkable. But that respect and admiration is just great.
And certainly helped by the fact that we have a president-elect who, I mean, we not only draw the comparisons, but he talks about Lincoln all the time. He is really making us look back to our history. And specifically, to answer this caller's question, not only do I know Max Daniels, I even know Donna Daniels, who does marry Lincoln.
Oh.
They're a couple from Wheaton, Illinois.
Oh. So
he thought he would trick me up, but I know these guys. There are wonderful, as our friend the reenactor must know, there are so many Lincoln reenactors. They have a word, and I can't remember what it is. It's not imitators. Presenters. They learn an astounding amount of information about Lincoln. They can go right into character and answer in 19th century vernacular, and they are wonderful tools to educate young kids. As this gentleman observed, they really turn them on to history and to a bigger-than-life character, much as Lincoln was.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. What did you think of Obama making his announcement in Springfield, the month of Abraham Lincoln's birth, and then showing up again to announce Joe Biden? I am such a sentimental person at times, and I'm from Illinois, and I love Abraham Lincoln. It really made me cry. I got to tell you, I was crying.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the time, I wasn't sure that he was going to succeed. I mean, he was certainly the underdog then.
Sure.
And, you know, there was a mixture of emotion and wondering whether it was appropriate. I mean, I think everybody, at least in New York, had that reaction. Can he really pull this off? And is he making a comparison to Lincoln? Or is he using Lincoln for inspiration? I think the general tone of it was that Lincoln was his inspiration. And that if Lincoln talked about unfinished work at Gettysburg, then there was no more giant a step that could be undertaken to complete the work, or at least move toward completing that unfinished work of race relations improvement in the United States, than to consider an African American seriously for the presidency. And then, of course, he gave a race speech in Philadelphia, where Lincoln gave a speech about equal opportunity on his way to Washington. So all of these echoes have been heard throughout this campaign, and I just think it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is amazing. Somebody suggested, I remember on this show a long time ago, it was right after that Springfield announcement, that there's no reason why he has to do his inauguration in Washington, D.C. He should be in Springfield.
Well, they asked Lincoln to do that, too. They thought instead of having a public inauguration, which is going to expose you to danger, you're going to have to be riding in an open carriage all the way to the Capitol, why don't we just swear you in Springfield and spirit you into Washington? And he said no. And it's an interesting question. And you know, the other interesting question is where – I know this is not of interest to the rest of the country who are watching the inauguration with great anticipation, but all of us who serve on the Federal Lincoln Bicentennial Commission, which I happen to be one of the chairs of, is watching to see where the president decides to spend his Lincoln's birthday. Hmm. Will it be a trip of memory and nostalgia back to Springfield?
Hmm.
Or will it be in the White House where Lincoln changed American history? It'll be an interesting decision to see whether he's looking back wistfully or looking ahead. I think we may learn something about him that we hadn't expected with this decision.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you must have some say-so in the decision, don't you?
Well, I know that there are lots of activities taking place, official activities taking place in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
There is a joint session of Congress. There's a major ceremony at the Lincoln Memorial. And there is a the opening of a major new exhibition of original Lincoln materials at the Library of Congress, things we'll never see together again in one place. So, you know, I'm in Washington, so I hope he is too. But Springfield is also having a major event and an exhibition at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. And I still remember the opening of that facility where President Bush spoke and Senator Obama spoke, and who knew that they would be predecessor and successor at one time, just a few years later.
Yeah, isn't that something? And why do you think, and it's not new for Obama, why do you think he's so taken by Lincoln? He reads about him extensively. Oh, what is it about Lincoln that has captivated him?
You know, I think two things. I think they share an extraordinary gift as writers, and they both in their time posed the question about whether serious, philosophically oriented writers about politics, whether writing speeches or other things, or letters in Lincoln's case, or could become serious candidates for the presidency just on the power of their words.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he saw that as an example. And certainly the other example is, have there ever been two presidents who more fulfilled the real promise, the original promise of America, that you could rise to the highest peaks of American opportunity,
yes,
simply by virtue of your talent and your hard work? Both of them have done that. No one would have pegged either Barack Obama or Abraham Lincoln as a child as a future leader. But they saw to it that they were educated. I mean, one through self-education and one through the best schools. They had experience in their communities. Lincoln as a serving in the military in New Salem and becoming a popular figure in his little town, and Obama becoming a community organizer. They both served in the state legislature in Springfield. I mean, they rose from the ranks, but they did it with such determination and a lack of, you know, likelihood that I think it binds them in a way.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jake from Menasha next. Hi, Jake.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I want a clarification. I was listening to the guest earlier, and did the guest say that the southern states did have a right to leave the Union?
I very firmly believe that they did not. I think that President Buchanan thought they didn't, but that he couldn't enforce their staying in the Union. No, I don't believe that the dissolution of the Union is imagined in the forming of the Union, and I know there's still debate about that, but, you know, I couldn't really write about Lincoln if I didn't believe in that fundamental truth.
Actually, and that's the follow-up question I have. I know there is a great debate about that,
yeah,
about whether the southern states did have or did not have the right to leave the Union. Is that debate still going on today, constitutionally?
Yeah, I think there are some constitutional scholars and Lincoln critics out there, and there is a body of Lincoln critics who say that that there was nothing in the Constitution that made the Union permanent. Lincoln's argument was that the Union actually predated the Constitution, that it's part of the Articles of Confederation, and that it's therefore bound almost sacredly into the birthing process of the country.
Hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk a little bit more about the power of the word. I found the chapters on his writing the first inaugural address to be extremely fascinating. And I guess I didn't have the knowledge that Seward was as helpful as he was and went through this. And actually, Lincoln took quite a few of his suggestions.
He did, not only small editing suggestions, words here and there to tone it down. Lincoln actually wrote a pretty bellicose draft of his inaugural when he was back home above his brother-in-law's store, but he turned to a lot of readers to look at it. It's, you know, basically we think of Lincoln as conducting a rather solitary writing process,
mm-hmm,
but he he relied on a lot of assistants, and Seward was certainly one of them. He wasn't the only one. But Seward is the one who gave him, interestingly, the line that Senator Obama quoted during his victory celebration. "Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection." He said that in he said that at his at Grant Park. Those words were actually written by William Seward, not by Abraham Lincoln. They were refined and edited beautifully by Lincoln, but they were Seward. So it's sort of amusing that, you know, I think Obama might have to turn to Hillary Clinton for his final words in his inauguration if we want to keep this parallel going.
Oh, I think he does just fine by himself.
Exactly.
Yeah, don't you think? When you talk about refining the words, though, he, and this is so true, he was a profound writer, but he may have even been a better editor because he could refine.
Well, the Seward thing was interesting, and the notion was interesting. The idea that you know, America has more in common than it has to divide them. But Lincoln just took it and phrase for phrase made it magical syntactically.
Yes.
And just, he was a poet, and he was an editor poet as well, as you point out. Yeah, he did that only a few times that we know of, but and you know, we don't really have a lot of drafts of his remarks. We do have things that have crossouts in them, and it's always interesting. I just saw a new document that's being, it's not new, it's freshly available. It's the speech that Lincoln made on the night of his re-election to the presidency from the window of the White House. A famous speech, and it's been in private hands all these decades.
My.
And there's one part where he crosses out a word and then puts the same word back. So he was he didn't edit himself a lot, but he edited others where he could.
Mm-hmm. And the copy where he did the editing of the first inaugural address, where is that? Will that be on display prominently now? Is it already?
It's never been on display permanently because, you know, these things do get damaged. His final inaugural and all of the drafts that preceded it, and there are about five, are in the Library of Congress in what we call the Abraham Lincoln Papers. They were retained by his secretaries, preserved by his son, who died in the 20s, and then we had to wait 25 years for them to open. So they've only been open to scholars since the late 1940s. But he had the inaugural set in type by the local newspaper before he went to Washington, thinking that it would be final. And by the time he got through rewriting it, literally cutting it up and pasting and cutting it and putting it on other pages, he had quite a mess when he got to the little table that was waiting for him at the Capitol. He had some handwritten, on printing with edits. He had some on the back of the page. And, you know, he put the whole thing down on a windy day on the table and then put his cane over it because he actually carried a cane that day, which was wise.
Yeah, it's good.
So it was a little messy, but he got through it.
Yeah. And there was a touching moment. Is it his hat that Stephen Douglas took his hat?
Yeah, and always doubted that myth. Well, he put the cane down and he was looking for a place for his hat. There was no room on the table. And Douglas, his lifelong opponent, supposedly his rival for Mary Todd's affections, all of that history between them, running against him for Senate and for the presidency, offered to hold his hat. So I doubted that, but I did find enough eyewitnesses to believe it. And then I found something else, that Stephen Douglas was one of those people to whom Lincoln showed the inaugural before he gave it. That Douglas then went before the Senate a few days later and endorsed it and said how wonderful it was. Douglas took his hat not only because they were old friends, you know, not really friends, old acquaintances, but because he had something invested in that inaugural address. He had vetted it too.
Isn't that amazing? Huh. Let's go to Boyd from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you?
All right, Boyd. How are you?
I'm doing well. I see you made it to work today. I commend you for that. Just before I, you know, considering the snowstorm and whatever.
Okay, I'm glad you explained
yes,
that.
We had a snowstorm.
Yeah, we had a little one in New York yesterday.
Yes. I just want to say before I get to my question, 2009 is just going to be such an exciting year in terms of history lovers like me, not only with the bicentennial birth of Abe Lincoln, but one of his birthday mates was a very well-known man for lovers of biology, Charles Darwin. They were both born on the exact same day.
Right.
And a few weeks prior to that, another famous individual in American history, Edgar Allan Poe, his bicentennial is also going to be there. So I find that just wonderful. My question is, with the way, though, that the Republican Party is now, I wonder if many would actually want to even identify themselves as the party of Lincoln, since it has changed so drastically. And how do you think modern Republicans still hold Lincoln, because it seems what he wanted for the country may not be consistent with what, not all across the board, mind you, but maybe some of the more neoconservatives may want
right.
for the country?
Well, there's no question that Lincoln was the first really activist executive. He imposed the first income tax. He called up armies of, hundreds of thousands of men. He suspended several constitutional privileges. He described himself as a conservative, but in fact he issued an executive order that confiscated slave property, millions of people potentially. So for years, every Republican convention was decorated with pictures of Abraham Lincoln, and every Democratic convention was decorated with pictures of Thomas Jefferson and Woodrow Wilson. And, history has sort of changed. Jefferson, has been exposed as something of a flawed man, as has Wilson. Both of them were racists. Maybe not so unusual in their own time, but really difficult for us to swallow today. And Lincoln was perhaps too activist. I mean, I think we can thank Franklin D. Roosevelt for, among other things, for muddling this to a degree that we don't have to worry about keeping Lincoln in one party closet or another, just looking to his ideals as they're appropriate to emulate at a particular time. It was FDR who made a big effort not only to get African-American voters to vote for Democrats for the first time. They basically didn't in 1932. Depression notwithstanding, they basically stayed loyal in large part to the Republican Party. It was only by 36 and 40 that Roosevelt had won over the black vote to the Democrats. And one of the ways he did it is by co-opting Lincoln. Lincoln was his tool for presidential authority. Lincoln was his tool to encourage us to fight in World War II. He cited Lincoln. He hired Robert E. Sherwood, the playwright of Abe Lincoln in Illinois, as his speechwriter. So he made Lincoln everybody's Lincoln more than anybody else, and he's sort of been fair game for presidents ever since.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, sure. Boyd. Thanks yep. for the call. We are going to continue taking your phone calls, and can also do an email if you'd like. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Harold Holzer. He is the author of Lincoln, President-Elect, Abraham Lincoln and the Great Secession Winter, 1860 to 1861. Harold is the co-chair of the U.S. Lincoln Bicentennial Commission. He has authored or co-authored 30 books on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. He is senior vice president for external affairs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and we're welcoming calls and emails, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now, and John is next from Westby. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Yes, this is John from Westby. I, too, am a Civil War reenactor. I've met Mr. Daniels that your previous caller called about, and I firmly believe that if Abraham Lincoln is not classified as a genius, he should be. And another little interesting note, my wife's ancestors migrated from Ohio to Wisconsin. And in her family tree, the Todd family pops up, and Mary Todd Lincoln.
Oh, really?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes. Hmm. So I've
well, it's appropriate because Wisconsin is, of course, the only state that has a statue of Mary Lincoln, as far as I know. I think in Racine, there's a great statue of Mary.
Hmm. I didn't know that. In Racine, huh?
Yeah.
All right. It's a way to celebrate Lincoln's birthday. Go see the statue. Yes, go ahead, John.
Also, not only the problems he had with the country at that time, with the Civil War and whatnot, his wife also caused him some minor, shall we say, discomforts.
You want to respond to that? What were those discomforts, Harold?
Well, I'd love to know what he's thinking about so I can comment.
Okay.
Well, she was criticized for the big spending spree in New York after the inauguration, refurbishing the White House. And
oh, sure.
She also had some mental problems and whatnot that he had to deal with, and especially after their son died, she pretty much went into seclusion, and he had to deal with that along with everything else he had on his plate.
Well, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, we don't know what the secrets of that marriage were and you know, whether she was a burden in her time. She was certainly a great comfort to him. You know, she kept that home fire going for 6 months out of the year that he was traveling. So I think, you know, my view of her as in those later years is, yeah, she might have become, quote, more of a problem, unquote, later. But, you know, that's why you sign on to the marriage contract. You just take the, you know, the worse with the better. And she was sick, basically. She wasn't doing it on purpose. And it's sort of a sad situation. And, of course, it made him, you know, it wore him down even more.
Mm-hmm. But you include, and I've read this before, about how when she was away in New York, I think specifically you make mention of this, he would pine for her.
Oh, yeah. Well, she was actually pretty naughty when she went off to New York. I mean,
yeah.
She demanded free railroad tickets. She went on these huge shopping sprees, opened accounts in all the big stores. And worse, she was heard condemning one of Lincoln's potential cabinet choices, trying to get, you know, make sure that he wasn't appointed. She didn't like Norman Judd of Illinois, and she, you know, wasted no breath in saying it. You know, she was a frustrated politician of sorts. And mm-hmm. So, you know, she was maybe more the Hillary Clinton of her day than anybody else, or could have been. She, you know, her father was a leading politician in Kentucky. She knew Henry Clay as a young girl. She heard politics spoken about in her home. And she loved it. She wanted to participate. She loved the idea of advising her husband and helping him. But in those days, of course, the women's sphere was very restricted, and there wasn't too much for her to do officially.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John, for the call. Let's go to Mike from Watertown. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could just sort of paint a picture of what was happening as far as his ability to plan, who he surrounded himself with, who he brought kind of to the table with him, knowing what was in store ahead of him. You know, it must have been, I can't imagine the complexity of that, but he must have given great thought from sun up till sun down. I'm just kind of curious who he surrounded himself with and how he was able to plan all this ahead of time.
You know, it was so much simpler. As grave as the crisis was compared to anything we've faced before or since, the staffing and advisory teams were so much simpler then. He had friends in Illinois to whom he had turned for years who helped make him president. Judge David Davis, his campaign manager. Senator Lyman Trumbull, who had once defeated him for the Senate. But then Trumbull went off to Washington for the December session of Congress. He hired one private secretary and then a second private secretary to sort of be the gatekeeper and to answer the mail. But he had newspaper editors, friendly newspaper editors with whom he had worked. Other than that, he was pretty much alone. He had to select cabinet ministers, you know, getting advice from other senators, but you know, all of them certainly were in Washington after a while, and it was hard to communicate in those days. So he basically is sitting in Springfield, Illinois, all alone. He did have a big meeting in Chicago, as we've discussed earlier, sitting in Washington and meeting with potential cabinet choices. He met with Edward Bates of Missouri, Salmon Chase of Ohio, Simon Cameron of Pennsylvania, all of whom he did invite into his official family. But he wasn't really, he wasn't surrounded by a transition team or a kitchen cabinet or a national security advisor or an economic team or any of that. I mean, his was a brand new political party. It had never been in power. He could not turn back, you know, as Senator Obama's doing, to some Clinton administration veterans. He was all alone out there.
Yeah. And answered letters. I was just struck by how few people he had helping him when
yeah.
he was elected president. There was nobody there.
Well, when he went to Washington, you know, the letters, which started out at about 250 a day, eventually reached 500 a day, and he had to get another secretary, but he wasn't allowed to. The White House budget only allowed,
goodness,
you know, two secretaries. I think they were paid $2,000 a year and $1,500 a year, maybe less. And so he had to get a third secretary, and he had him hired by the Department of the Interior to work as a secretary to sign land grants. And this secretary doubled as the correspondent secretary, and that was the third secretary. So that was the whole staff. They slept in the White House near the office, and they worked in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
They were never far from his side.
Hmm. Thanks for your call, Mike. Let's go to Tim from Appleton next. Hi, Tim.
Hi, this is Tim from Appleton.
Yes, hi, Tim.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. And first of all, thank you for a great discussion on this topic. Regarding the bicentennial celebrations, what activities are you aware of that may be occurring in and around Wisconsin? We know a lot about what's going to happen in Springfield and some of the East Coast
events, right.
But for those of us who are eager fans of all things Lincoln, what should we look forward to in Wisconsin?
Well, I think every state has a Lincoln Bicentennial Commission appointed by its governor, and every one of them has a Lincoln Bicentennial website. I'm hoping Wisconsin does. I know for years a Lincoln Fellowship of Wisconsin has existed and done very well in Wisconsin. I've spoken there myself a few times. Well, you're from Appleton. You're from the home of a guy named Robert French, who is one of the great Lincoln book collectors of the last 50 years and who's an old friend of mine. And I'll bet if you can find Robert French, you'll find out everything.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine, too. He did a great service to us all by giving much of his collection to the college here in Appleton, Lawrence.
In fact, the last time I saw him in New York, he was just here. He showed me a photograph of himself standing in front of all of the books that he donated to the college. Well, he's a great guy. I hope he knows about it as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks for the call. Mark from Appleton. Hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Fine. How are you, Mark?
Great. I want to thank you for this discussion. This is a great discussion, and I am proud to still be a Republican, member of the Republican Party. My question to you is, could you expand? A lot of things that I've read on Abraham Lincoln has been about his faith in God. Could you expand a little bit about what you've surveyed on his faith with God?
Yes, of course. You know, Lincoln grew up in a Baptist church tradition with his parents. Read the Bible as his first reading book. Learned the Bible, committed a lot of it to memory, ingested it, breathed it. I think he eventually grew unhappy with organized churches and organized religion. At least he never joined a church. He never committed himself to a congregation. Even when his wife joined a church in Springfield, he went along to services occasionally, but he never committed himself to what we would call a family membership in that Presbyterian church in Springfield. In Washington, he was deeply comforted by ministers who attended to him when he lost his son. He attended sermons in churches, usually sitting in the minister's office so he wouldn't disrupt services, and read the Bible more and more, and wrote meditations about divine will as he searched for explanations about how a just God could allow a country to murder so many of its own citizens in the name, variously, of liberty and bondage and union and separation. I mean, he anguished about whether he was a divine instrument or what he should do and to fulfill God's mission, and eventually became quite fatalistic about the fact that God, in fact, was willing that the contest continue without trying to say he was on God's side. He was always just hoping that God was on his side. So it's a complicated story. It's a non-traditional story. I think he was a very profound believer in God without being what we would call religious.
Can you imagine, as we think and have talked about the length of time now between winning a presidential election and your inauguration, it was even longer. Have you thought about what would have happened, and this maybe doesn't get us anywhere except it's interesting to me, what would have happened if instead of this four-month period of time where he's waiting to become president and all this turmoil is taking place, it had only been a month between the two events.
Yeah.
Would it that made of some kind of difference?
I think it might have. I think if he, you know, the secession occurred mostly in January and February. December started in December. You know, I think if he had extended an official olive branch with reassurances, that's if you assume that this wasn't going to happen anyway. As Lincoln put it, the tug has to come, and better now than later. But, you know, there's something to be said for moving up these dates. You know, the founders did not contemplate a four-month waiting period. When March 4th was sort of evolved as Inauguration Day, it was basically because the Electoral College was meeting in February, and it was only 4 or 5 weeks between the election and the and the inauguration. The founders did not contemplate a national election day in November. So, you know, an argument can be made that even January 20th is arbitrary and too late. FDR moved that up in 1936. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe we should be somewhere between what we have now in the British system, where when the new prime minister is elected, they throw the other guy's stuff out in the street, and he moves into 10 Downing Street in a few hours. Maybe a little more, a little nicer than that, but maybe faster. Even January, I mean, we all seem to have the feeling even now, and this is what it was like then, that the waiting is anguishing. And,
right.
Yeah.
Maybe it should be changed. And let's talk a little bit more about where he looked. I think somebody asked this question, if not you, southward for sympathy during this 4-month period. Did he find people who wanted to help him along? Did he cultivate those sympathetic leanings on the part of some Southerners?
Oh, yes, but he was thwarted each time.
Hmm.
At least his best friend, Joshua Speed, his friend from Springfield, his roommate at one time, although he wouldn't serve in his cabinet, at least became a leading loyalist in his native state of Kentucky and helped keep Kentucky sort of stable during the Civil War. Lincoln was always worried about Kentucky, and with good reason. But he reached out to Southerners in the beginning of the transition period to consider joining his cabinet. He thought that there were several people in North Carolina and Virginia who could serve, and that by their service, they could possibly keep their states loyal, although he began soon to wonder what would happen if he hired them and then they would leave, the states seceded. So he was concerned, and I guess his bitterest disappointment was when he opened a correspondence with his old one-time Whig Party colleague in Congress, Alexander Hamilton Stevens, who was as tiny as Lincoln was gigantic. He was about 5 feet tall, maybe.
Oh, my.
Consumptive, frail. Lincoln was, of course, this great, big, strong guy, but they hit it off when they served in Congress together, and Lincoln thought he was one of the greatest orators he'd ever seen. He talked about how he had cried when he heard his speech on the House floor once, and he reached out to Stevens. They had correspondence. He assured him they had no differences other than the fact that he thought slavery was right and ought to be extended, and Lincoln felt it was wrong and ought to be stopped, at least in its tracks. And eventually, not only did Stevens actually went to the Georgia Secession Convention in January and argued against secession, but once Georgia did secede, he not only went with Georgia, he became vice president of the Confederacy. And I think that was a bitter disappointment for Lincoln and taught him the lesson that it was really going to be a regional war.
Yeah. And going back to where you end the book, and that's the first inaugural address. Well, there's stuff after that, but it's a wonderful
postscript,
chapter.
Yeah.
Right, postscript. He knew how important that address was. I was interested in how people responded to what they heard that day. There were a huge number of people in Washington to listen to Lincoln. What did they think?
Well, of course, most of the crowds that assemble at these kinds of things are made up of fans.
Mm-hmm.
But Washington was also a very southern city with slaves. And free blacks who were kept rather downtrodden. So, there were varying reports. It's very hard to tell. He was greeted with a big shout and yell when he appeared. He was greeted with applause. Some people, though, reported that when he finished, he sort of sighed because he hadn't gotten the reaction he wanted. Of course, it was a windy day. You know, he was speaking without a microphone to 15 or 20,000
people. Isn't that something?
Ugh. And how they did it, I still don't know. They all must have sounded like Pavarotti or something. You know, people who say Lincoln had a weak voice don't take into account the fact that you couldn't be a professional politician if you had a weak voice. Bill Clinton could never have made it. Obama, maybe. I haven't heard him without a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think of all the recent presidents. Only the ones who have booming voices mm-hmm. could have been successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was amazed that he could be heard by at least 10,000 people. How can anybody be heard by 10,000 people?
I know. I'm sure that lots of people in the back didn't hear it. They just wanted to be spectators at a great nation-altering event. But, you know, the reaction was very partisan. The Democratic press thought it was thought it was inflammatory, and the Republican press thought it was terrific.
Yeah. Well, as you, of all people, know, he is an endlessly fascinating man, isn't he?
I'm not done with them yet, and I hope the readers aren't either, because I find it absolutely, you know, it's unendingly fascinating. And, you know, among the many reasons that Senator Obama has made people happy is he certainly made the Lincoln community happy, because he is so interested and attentive and fascinated by Lincoln. He sort of lifted the whole field to new levels. And, you know, it's a, I'm speaking selfishly, obviously, but also from another point of view, from the point of view of the notion that history really can be a guide, not just a, you know, not just a distraction. It's wonderful to be welcoming a new president who sees examples that can, from the past, that can illuminate the future.
Thank you so much for the book. It was great. Thank you for being with us, Harold.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Harold Holzer, H-O-L-Z-E-R, and the book is Lincoln, President-Elect, Abraham Lincoln and the Great Secession Winter, 1860 to 1861. Harold is the co-chair of the U.S. Lincoln Bicentennial Commission, and he's written or co-authored a number of books on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War. He's the winner of a Lincoln Prize for Lincoln at Cooper Union, and he is Senior Vice President for External Affairs at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. That was fun, huh? Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program, and to Rob Schroeder for on-air production, and thanks, everybody, for calling. This is the Ideas Network.